Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show,
Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of the Hoops Adjacent episode of Athletic NBA Show. David Aldrich here in D.C. In L.A., my man Waz Lambre. Waz, what's up, sir?
I'm good, man. I'm chilling. I'm not going to lie. I'm still pretty sad about how the Super Bowl turned out. But life goes on, I guess, even for us miserable Jets fans.
Wait. So did you have a little action on Kansas City?
Or? No, I just never want to see Tom Brady do well.
You sound like my sons, man. They were all upset.
For any reason whatsoever. It's enough already. I mean, come on.
Like, this is what I told them. I'm sorry he's this good. What do you want me to do?
I know. I've been in denial about it. I'm like, well, you know, they did have Belichick and they were kind of cheating and, you know, it might not work this time.
Come on, man. You got to give the dude props now. He's good.
Yeah.
Now.
It's tough.
I know you don't want to. It's all good, though. It's all good.
And it was a horrible game,
it was
too.
Awful.
That's another thing.
It was awful.
It was just a horrible game.
It was awful.
So,
I want to ask you.
But it's Tuesday now.
I don't want to keep our guest, but I ask you afterwards what you thought of the weekend, because I got some thoughts on that. But we'll talk about that afterwards.
Okay.
I want to get our guest in this week. Guy that I have known for years, one of the good guys in this league, man. And I'm so happy that he's got this very unique opportunity to be the head coach of the G League Ignite squad that many of you have heard about over the last few months. It's a new thing that the NBA is trying to do to kind of be, I guess, you know, better shepherds for some of the young guys coming in and give them better opportunities. Brian Shaw, man, thank you for joining us, man. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
B. Shaw, I've known B. Shaw for, 20 years, man. You know, so always one of the good dudes. And you all start play. We're taping this on Tuesday. The G League team starts play on Wednesday night. They will be in the bubble with the other teams in the G League that have opted in and are playing in the bubble in the G League season. They're playing the Santa Cruz Warriors on Wednesday night, or Wednesday morning, I should say, at 11 a.m., Wednesday morning from Advent Health Arena at the ESPN Wide World of Sports Complex. It'll be live on ESPN2. I'm sure many of you know what the kind of marching orders for G League Ignite is going to be this year. It's different. They have brought in some of the guys that normally would have gone to college, would have been one and done players, guys like Jonathan Kuminga and Jalen Green and Isaiah Todd, Deshaun Nix. They are on a select team with some real good NBA vets, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, Brian. But good guys, Jarrett Jack and Amir Johnson, guys that have been in the league for, you know, a decade or more, old heads that can teach some of these young guys what it really means to be a pro. Brian, the first thing I wanted to ask you, man, is just kind of how did you get intrigued by this job? Because this is about developing these young guys. It is about winning and losing, obviously, but it really is about getting these guys ready to be NBA players. And I wonder what excited you about that.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, the first thing was I was just doing NBA TV and as well as 25 games for the local team where I live, the Golden State Warriors, pregame, halftime, and after the game, since I make my home in the Bay Area up in Oakland. And there weren't any NBA teams, you know, if I'm being honest, that were just beating on my door to give me an opportunity to get back and be a head coach again. And then, you know, one day I get a call from Sharif Abdur-Rahim, who's the commissioner, president of the G League. And he started talking to me about this vision, that he had, and conversations that he was having with Adam Silver and Mark Tatum, the deputy commissioner of the NBA, about, as you put it, being better shepherds for these young guys who had been up to this point opting to either go to college and be one and done or go overseas, in the case of LaMelo Ball and RJ Hampton from last year's draft class, and to give an alternative route or pathway to getting to the NBA, but that it would be a select group of guys that they would hand select to be a part of this and sprinkle in some veterans. You know, you named a couple of them, Amir Johnson, it ended up being, and Jared Jack and Bobby Brown, to kind of, form this team and help develop these young guys and teach them how to be pros on and off the court. And the more we talked about it, the more intrigued I got with it. And, and as an assistant coach in the NBA, that was a big part of what I was doing anyway, was developing a lot of young players, going back to, Andrew Bynum, who came straight out from high school, to, to Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball, who, were one and dones, in LA, Paul George and Lance Stevenson, guys that I worked with in Indiana, So I spent a lot of time doing that, and being on the other end of it as a coach in the NBA, getting a lot of these guys and saying, it would be nice if they were more ready. Like, obviously their athleticism is off the charts. Their talent is as well, but not really up to par in terms of like really understanding what it takes to be a pro and the work ethic behind it and things of that nature. And so this provides that opportunity and also introduces them to the terminology that NBA teams use, the offensive sets that they run, the defensive schemes that they run, but also the business of basketball and everything that comes along with that. And so it was just like a perfect storm for me. And then lo and behold, there was probably, six or seven different locations around the country that they were discussing possibly being the home base for this program. And it ended up being in Walnut Creek, California, up in Northern California in the Bay Area, which is a 15-minute drive from where I live in Oakland. So when all those things came together, it just made sense. Along with the fact that we were dealing with the pandemic, and it was nice to be able to be home in this time, with my family and some of my elderly relatives that we take care of. It just all made sense.
Man, B-Shaw, Dave talked about it at the top of the show. Just like this team is kind of unique, right? It's not like when you're in the NBA saying you got like a really young team and it's like, all right, sure, we're trying to develop these guys as players, but we need to be developing winning habits, right? Like, we don't want to reward guys who are doing, non-winning stuff and still reward them with playing time. It's like this delicate balance with young guys, whereas this G League team is a little bit different. I'm curious because, in preparation for the show, I'm like, man, B-Shaw played in the league for 15 years. He played on the Shaq and Penny Magic teams. He played on the Shaq and Kobe Laker teams. He spent 20 years on NBA benches. Like, you've seen so much. What do you think is unique to these guys and what they need to know and learn how they're going to become successful pros?
I think it's a good question, and I think it's just being introduced to the routine of, and I don't say routine like just casual routine, but, wrapping their minds around, once they signed on the dotted line, it changed everything that they'd experienced up to this point. Because once you sign on the dotted line, you are receiving compensation for your play, you're considered a professional. And with that becomes a lot, comes a lot of responsibility and obligations. And in this day and age, you're on all the time because of social media, because of camera phones. You're not going to get away with anything. And so you have to be cognizant of that at all times. And exposing them, to all of these type of things and breaking a lot of the bad habits that they have built up to this point, playing AAU basketball or high school basketball for them, up to this point, where in a weekend, you know, they may play 12 games, you know, three games a day or four games a day, that where there's not really any consequence for the bad habits that they may develop, you know, in playing, where winning doesn't really matter because, you know, you got two or three more games that same day over the weekend. And, you know, and so this, although for us, our team is unique and it's not predicated on wins and losses for us. We still want to try to win every game, you know, that we step on the floor. We also want to build winning habits, practice those and get repetition at them every single day. And the biggest issue from the beginning in terms of actually on the basketball court was each of these guys that you named, Dacian Nix, Isaiah Todd, Jalen Green, and Jonathan Kuminga, all up to this point have been, you know, the stars of their AAU teams or their programs that they've come from. They've all played with the ball in their hand, you know, and got to shoot as much as they, you know, wanted to. And getting them to understand that now the next step for them next year when they're rookies on some NBA team, that they are not, the coach is not going to just hand them the ball and say, dribble the ball 15 or 17 times until you can create your own shot, you know, what have you. You're going to have to play a role. And so with all things being equal, if there's five players on the court and there's only one basketball, there's only one person that can have the ball at a time. So that's 20% of the time if there's five people on the court that you have the ball in your hand. And we need to learn how to play the other 80% of the time that we don't have the ball in our hand, when we're one of those other four guys that don't have the ball. So things like spacing the court, setting good screens to open up your teammate, which in turn will allow you to get open, how to cut hard and be a good teammate without having to dominate and impact the game without having to have the ball in your hand. To me, those are the most important things. And one of the examples that I use is Steph Curry. Now, we know he's a monster when he has the ball in his hand because of all the things that he can do. But when he gives the ball up and the defense relaxes for a second, that's when he's even more dangerous, because when that defender relaxes, he's cutting down the lane and then coming off another down screen on the other side. And so it's perpetual motion, you know, with him. And that's what makes him dangerous. And that's what opens it up for his teammates. And so just trying to get them to trust that and understand that when you give the ball up, it'll find its way back to you. And so, you know, that was a little bit of a struggle, if I'm being honest, you know, at the very beginning.
Yeah.
But they're starting to see that, you know, that there are other aspects of the game that they need to brush up on, because like I said, you know, when they look at one of the people that they've always, that resonated with them was Kobe. They yeah. all idolized Kobe. And, you know, making them understand, like, did you realize that when Kobe came straight out of high school, that he didn't play very much his rookie year and even his second year? And neither did Tracy McGrady. You know, and
right.
guys like Dirk Nowitzki and Kevin Garnett,
yeah,
they struggled, you know, in their first year when they came
KD too.
Into the league.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, KD as well. So it wasn't like it was just instant success. Yeah. And the guy that you got, you know, these guys that you guys look up to and idolize, they had to put in work and they had to pay their dues, and they got better in time from putting in work, but it wasn't instant for them, and it's not going to be instant for you.
Yeah.
But you're going to get a head start coming through this program, playing against some grown ass men that you are, you know, that are looking at you. They're jealous of you in a lot of ways, because, you know, what, I don't know what the salary of a G League player is, $35,000 to $50,000,
right,
for a season. And you know, some of our young guys are making in upwards of $500,000.
Yeah.
Right. So they're looking at a young guy at 18 years old playing in the G League, making 10 times the salary that they're making. And you know, so now you're taking some food off of their table, and you know, like I said, they're grown and physically stronger and more mature. And that's what you're going to face on a night in and night out at this level. Yeah. You know, guys that are hungry, that are trying to get to the league, and, you know, and they're looking at you and jealous of you. And so you got to be ready for that physicality that's going to be coming your way. And I think that once we got here to the bubble in Orlando, around all of these other teams, you know, we're all staying in the same, in the same hotel complex, they're seeing, you know, these other guys are seeing the attention that's around this team. And, you know, it's causing some hate and some resentment. Yeah. And they can feel it and they can see it. But that's also good, you know, to prepare them. And you know, they're not going to back down from it. They're going to stand up to the challenge. And, you know, they've all gotten better since they got here. And like I told them, we've been everything up to this point. I've been with this group since August 28th was our first day with just the young guys. And all of this up to this point has just been homework, right? We've been doing homework. And tomorrow we can finally get to take the first test.
Right. So
we're looking forward to that.
You said some of the – you scrimmaged some of the other G League teams, and they kind of took it to you young guys, right?
Yeah, so the first – we had a group of G League guys that we played 4 days in a row. We split with them two games. Then they put together a better group of G League guys that we played probably another month after that, before we got out here. And they whooped us for, you know, they whooped us two games in a row. But I expected that. We didn't have, at that time, we didn't have Jared Jack. We didn't have, I think Amir had just gotten here. We didn't have Bobby. So, you know, there was a couple of, you know, we didn't have a full team. And in their defense, we hadn't been able to have 5-on-5 practices even leading up to those scrimmages because of the protocol, because of, we just didn't have the numbers. We hadn't had added all our veteran players yet. But, you know, give credit to that team. They took it to us. I think both games they beat us, you know, in excess of 20 points. And, but that other team also left knowing the skill set and the talent of these young guys that were on this team as well. You know, and so they shine, but, you know, they wore us down. And so, you know, we were able to add some vets. Now we can work together as a group. We finally have, you know, more than 10 players, so we can scrimmage and have group workouts, which we couldn't do for the first 3.5 months. You know, so yesterday we had a kind of a tune-up scrimmage against that same team that had whooped us those prior two scrimmages, and we beat them pretty handily yesterday. You know, so it showed improvement from our point standpoint, and you know, like I said, our guys. Really prove that they belong at this level and that they deserve the hype that they've been getting.
I wanted to be sure. Do you feel responsibility or a pressure even to make sure that this works, right? Like the league obviously has invested in this and they see this as something worthy and worthwhile that they should be trying to do. And they've put it in your hands, right? Like, you know, guys are going to come out of this and players talk to each other. Do you feel any pressure to make sure that you're making this work in a way that everybody understands why this is worthwhile and why we should be doing this?
I don't really feel any pressure when it comes to doing anything really that has to do with basketball, to be honest with you. I understand the investment that the NBA made. All the 17 teams that opted into this format and this setting, the only reason why this is going on is because of our team. That's the only reason, because G League teams don't make money.
Right.
And teams have pony up a lot of money. I believe $500,000 a team,
right,
to be a part of this. And it was to give these guys the exposure and the competition that they needed. And so we understand that going in. But in terms of pressure for me, basketball is a game, regardless of whatever role you play in it, as a coach, as a support staff, as a player, you know, whatever. It's a game that you should find joy in. You should enjoy competing and having fun. And I truly believe that when you're true to the game will be true to you. Or, you know, you pay your dues will pay you back. So we put on a hard hat, we come in and we work. And, you know, and I believe that, you know, that work will pay off. You know, I've told each and every one of these guys that I can't help you, or I can't make you get drafted or guarantee that you're going to be drafted or whatever. But what I can do is make sure that you're a better player than you were when you got here, that you understand the nuances of the game at this level, the terminology, that you have the footwork and the fundamentals that that you're going to need to perform at that next level, from getting the repetition, doing that every single day. And as long as you bring the attitude that you're going to work, we've surrounded these guys with, you know, the two coaches that I have on my staff, Rashid Hazard, Walt Hazard's son, who right. he was with us in L.A.
Yeah.
On the Lakers staff, and went to New York Knicks with Derek Fisher. Chris Farr was on my staff with me in Denver. He was also a college assistant coach for about 16 years, right. and you know, was a really good recruiter. And so we've seen, you know, just, you know, with that being, that's our coaching staff, you know, guys that have NBA experience, have college experience. I played for the U.S. team. I played, you know, obviously in the NBA. I played overseas a year in Italy. And, you know, you got Sharif Abdur-Rahim, who's the president, who's around us a lot, who they can lean on as well. You have Rod Strickland, who, you know, is our program manager, but recruited most of these guys and their families to, you know, to come to this program that's around all the time, that that they can lean on as well. So we, and then our trainer, Pete Youngman, was a trainer for the Sacramento Kings for 16 years. And our strength and conditioning coach was with Sacramento and their G League organization as well. So they're surrounded by NBA, you know, people that have NBA experience at every level, that also help get the message across and get them accustomed to, you know, the daily routine of things and, you know, what's expected of them. And to be honest with you, I feel more pressure as a Black man, you know, being a, you know, kind of a father figure, teacher, and coach in terms of all the things that are going on outside of the game for these young men, you know, right. with obviously the pandemic, with everything that's going on in terms of social justice and injustice, you know, all the political BS that they got to see under the past idiot president that we had, you know, and things of this nature, and all the traps that are out there set for them. I feel, you know, responsibility and an obligation to prepare them for that more so than the basketball part, because that part is, to me, is fun. So there's no pressure with that.
Man, I want to talk to you about that, because I don't think, maybe some of the younger listeners don't understand your experience when you came out of college after your first year in Boston. You decided to sign with Il Messaggero. And I don't think people remember, some people may not remember what a big deal that was, B. Like, that was a big deal back in 1989. You know, Brian had a Black agent, Jerome Stanley, and he was in Boston. True. He was in Boston
telling
Red Auerbach to stick it. I'm going to go make this money playing in Italy. And I cannot tell you what came down on Brian's head for making that decision. And I just wonder, man, if that, how you kind of take those memories about that and apply it to what you just said, talking to these young brothers about making sure they make good decisions and making sure when they take stands, there will be consequences for taking those stands.
Well, no question about it. And you know, we take every opportunity when, you know, like when it was Martin Luther King's birthday, you know, last month, and the holiday, and just talking about the significance of it and the significance of the man itself and all the struggles that, you know, that us as Black people and just minorities in this country as a whole have to go through and endure. And we did a voters registration thing. We registered all the guys who had just turned 18, you know, to vote and, you know, understand the importance of that. And that whole insurrection that was at the Capitol, when you really look at it and you think about it, they were doing that because they were mad about the vote. Right. And not wanting us to vote and just understanding, you know, it more in depth than what you just see and hear. And, you know, going back to what you talked about in 1989, David, that was for me my first lesson in the business of basketball. Right. Up to that point, I played for the love of the game, for the competition of it, what have you. And when I got drafted by the Celtics in 88, they were at the salary cap. They were at the tip of the salary cap. And so I had to sign as a first round pick. I had to sign a minimum contract. And so what I did was with my agent was bet on myself and say, you know what? I'm confident that I can play in this league. I belong. So we're going to just sign a 1-year deal so that I can become a restricted free agent after my first year in the league. So that since I'm at the salary cap and I'm going to basically be underpaid, instead of locking into an underpaid deal for 3 or 4 years or 5 years at that time and letting this team kind of take advantage of the situation, I'm only going to sign a 1-year deal. And so I ended up starting 62 games my rookie year, made the all rookie second team. And it gave me a lot of leverage because they didn't draft another point guard that following year. They drafted Mike Smith, the small forward out of Brigham Young.
Right.
And Dennis Johnson was getting older. They traded Danny Ainge during my rookie year. And so it was just me left. And when they came with the qualifying offer after that first year, I told them, I said, hey, you got to come with it. This other team from Italy, that was the same year that Danny Ferry got drafted as the second pick by the Clippers and didn't want to go play.
And said, no, I'm not going. I'm not going to play for Donald Sterling.
Right.
So he went and played for this team in Italy, Il Messaggero. Mm-hmm. David Falk was his agent, got in contact with my agent, said, hey, they're looking for another young American player. No first round picks after 1 year in the NBA had ever done anything like that before. And so when they came with the little BS offer that they came with, which I think was, it would have taken me from $150,000, which I made my rookie year, to a 3-year deal starting at $225,000 going forward. This team literally offered me $1 million to take one season.
Oh my God.
So, I said, okay, I can stay here and play 4 years in Boston at $225 a year and make $1 million, or I can go and play 1 year in Italy and play 35 games and make $1 million and still be playing the game that I love to play. Right. On top of, I grew up on the West Coast, right? So I hated the Celtics growing up.
Right.
So it wasn't really at that time, it wasn't a big deal, you know, for me. But as David mentioned, the wrath came down on me for making that decision, but I bet on myself. And like I said, it was my first lesson in the business of basketball and, you know, and everything, you know, obviously worked out. But there was a lot behind it. The Celtics ended up coming over halfway during that season and then making me a proper offer, which they should have done in the first place. And then I ended up coming back and, you know, and the rest is history.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you take that, you tell your young guys about your lessons and help them try to make those not similar decisions, but make decisions out of knowledge, you know, you knew you were underpaid. You should be getting paid more. Right. And whether it's not going to be necessarily your NBA contract, but it might be your shoe deal. You know what I mean? It might be your endorsement deal. It might be what you're paying your agent. You know what I mean?
Right. So I tread lightly, but I do make sure that you know, I try to make sure that they understand, first of all, that their agents work for them. And it's not the other way around. You don't work for your agent. So if your agent presents something to you that you're uncomfortable with or you don't like, you know, whatever, you don't have to do it because you're the boss. And but you do have to have some knowledge on it. You do have to do some research, you know, behind it. But understand that it is a business. And even with your agents, right, before you kind of became who you are, people weren't flocking to you. They are now because you have something there's something for them to gain off of you. And so you have to have that, you know, in the back of your mind always. But, you know, just one of the things too that I learned is that they're not really interested in hearing my story, or anything that doesn't really involve them.
Yeah.
So I have to be creative about how I get that message across. And you know, in an analogy or something that relates to, you know, something that they like where they can get the lesson, you know, out of it, but make it about them, you know. So, you know, I have found creative ways of getting those points across, the lessons that I've learned, passing that on to them, but applying it to their situations. When it comes to family, friends, agents, and just the business overall, you know, you have to take charge of your own life and make those the best decisions for you.
So is this something you want to be doing long term? Like, do you like the idea of helping shape the future of the NBA via G League Ignite? Do you want to become a head coach again? I know your stint in Denver didn't end the way you would have liked it to, and it was, you know, probably not as long as you would have liked it to last. Are you trying to get back into NBA coaching? How do you see this thing panning out?
Well, fortunately, I have, you know, done pretty well for myself. So I'm in a position where I can do whatever feels nice. The best for me that doesn't have to, that's not just totally dependent on money. So for instance, I probably could have been, you know, up until 2019, when I was on Luke Walton's staff with the Lakers, I was the highest paid assistant in the NBA. And I probably could have taken a job on somebody's staff this year and made three times the money that I'm making as the head coach of this team. So to answer your question, I could see myself continuing to do this, because I enjoy it. I think it's an important job. It's an important responsibility to have that keeps me connected to the game, that keeps me helping to impact these young guys, that keeps me in the mix in terms of the NBA. And the service that I'm doing for them and their next wave of stars that are coming up. I think that this thing can grow and it can expand. But on the flip side of it now, every GM and every scout for every NBA team that wants any kind of intel or evaluation or whatever on these young guys, they got to come through me. You know, I don't have the same structure of management over my head, you know, in terms of an NBA team with the general manager and stuff like that, that they make the draft pick, they draft these young guys, they may not pan out, but the coach is the one who falls on the sword when they make a mistake.
Right.
And, you know, Sharif basically said, hey, you got an empty slate. You got to create your own program, your own way of doing this, you know, and so I don't really, in that regard, I don't have anybody to answer to. So I wouldn't go back and take another NBA job if it wasn't the right fit for me, if I didn't feel like I had the proper support from management and ownership. And if that didn't present itself, I would be perfectly fine, you know, continuing to do this. you know, I'm not out looking for a job. I want to do, I have a job. I want to do, make the most out of this situation that I'm in. And I'm really, really, enjoying it. I mean, obviously this year was a little weird with the pandemic and all of that. It wasn't, you know, the way that we anticipated everything going. But with that being said, you know, we've been able to pivot and make it work. And I think that these young guys are getting, a, you know, a lot out of it.
B-Shaw is good, Waz. That's what he's trying to tell you.
Yeah. He said his pockets are straight.
He good. I wanted to ask you one more thing. I know you got to run, man. I don't want to keep you, but you obviously are very, very connected, have been for most of your career with the Lakers. You played for them. You won championships with them. You and Shaq were close. He was one of the few. You were one of the few guys, I should say, that could curse Shaq out and he wouldn't, you know, like, take it personally. Like you had that kind of relationship with him, and you were there with LeBron in LA before, you know, AD got there, and after AD got there. And so I just wonder, you have been there to see those kind of superstar dynamics, and it worked as long as it worked with Kobe and Shaq, right? Until it didn't, but it worked long enough to win three right. chips. And I just wonder what makes it work? What makes it work when you have two big egos, big talents that have to play together for the team to be successful? What is it that LeBron and AD got right last year to make that dynamic work? And what maybe did Shaq and Kobe struggle with in their time?
Well, I don't think that I think that the thing in terms of Shaq and Kobe really struggling, that was more, I think, overblown by the media, right? Like, they got along on the basketball court when it came time to playing and getting between the lines and getting done what needed to be done. They did that. They just weren't hangout buddies when the game wasn't going on. You know, right. You weren't going to see them out, you know, having dinner, having a drink together or anything like that,
right.
You know, off the court. And I think that's pretty common. You know, when I played in Boston, Kevin McHale and Larry Bird didn't, you know, they didn't hang out, you know, with each other off the court, but they respected each other's game and stuff on the court. And I think with LeBron and AD, you know, they both are represented by the same agency. And what have you. And if that situation was probably more admiration or adoration or whatever you want to call it, from AD, you know, kind of looking up to LeBron, whereas Kobe right. and Shaq, Kobe wasn't looking up to anybody, you know, Shaq right. was older than him, whatever, it didn't matter. I'm an alpha dog, you an alpha dog, and we're going to establish some pecking order around here.
Yeah.
And that's what was perceived the problem between them. But I think that both LeBron and AD don't have that same kind of killer in them like Kobe and Shaq had, you know, so that's what allowed them to, you know, to coexist with one another. And at the end of the day, what makes it work is when you got two to three guys that can really, really play and, you know, are at the best, you know, they're, at the best in their positions, and a decent supporting cast around them, then it works. And if you don't believe me, ask, Greg Popovich, who over the last couple, you know, obviously has had a lot of success, but when he didn't have the top players like he, you know, had with David Robinson, Tim Duncan, you know, Ginobili, Parker, and those guys, it's been a struggle for him the last couple of years, as well as any other coach who doesn't have stars. So I don't care how well that you can coach, you know, or whatever else, when it comes down to the end game, which is winning the championship, if you don't have those star players, most likely you're not gonna be playing in that final game, you know, across the board. So the teams, you know, when you look back over what probably the last 30 years, there's maybe what 8 or 9 teams that have won championships. And that's it, because those 8 or 9 teams had the best players and the best supporting staff for the most part. And, you know, you could bring in Vince Lombardi and Bill Belichick or whoever else. You know, look, that's a perfect example. You guys were talking about the Super Bowl and Tom Brady. Well, he didn't have Brady first time this year and all the other guys that went along with it, and they didn't make the playoffs. You know, Brady had, you know, he had weapons in Gronk and the running backs and the coaching staff that I do give a lot of respect to Bruce Arians for having a black offensive coordinator, black defensive coordinator, some black coaches in other key positions and positional coaches, as well as I think he has a couple of women
as
well.
He's got two women,
you know,
yeah,
given those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, and so when you have that kind of support staff around you, and then you have, you know, Brady, whether we like him or not, is the GOAT. And at that position, and, you know, Antonio Brown and Gronk, who can still play, and Fournette, and, you know, and the guys that they have on the defensive side of the ball, then, you know, you're going to win. And so that's across the board.
Man, what I tell you was, I'm telling you, back in the day, he's in Boston. Boston? 22-year-old brother telling Boston fans and Boston media, nah, I'm going to go over here for a minute. I can't tell you what that was like.
That took some cojones.
David, you know, the first 30 games when I came back from Italy to play for the Celtics,
yeah,
our home fans booed me every time I touched the ball.
That's unbelievable.
And they called me, that's a whole nother show. They called me Benedict Arnold.
No.
you know, I felt like, and I mean, obviously it wasn't to the extent, but I felt like how Bill Russell and some of the players from the earlier days felt when they, or maybe like Jackie Robinson when he broke the color barrier for Major League Baseball. That's how I felt with how the wrath was coming down on me from the Boston fans and even the media out there.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
It's crazy.
It was crazy.
I remember they had a picture in the paper when we were in court. Mm-hmm. Of myself and Jerome Stanley. Jerome had on a green suit with pinstripes. And Jerome is an attorney. He's an agent, but he's also an attorney.
Right.
And in the Boston Herald, they called him this flashy dressing, slick talking agent. But, you know, they degraded him.
Oh, my God.
And he's because of what he had on.
My man, I appreciate your time so much. Best of luck with you, with your team this year, and with everything else going on. Stay safe down there, man. And man, hopefully we'll see you in an arena again real soon, man.
All right, I appreciate you guys, man. Appreciate you having me on. It was a lot of fun, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, B-Shaw. Right, later, bro.
Yeah, it was crazy, man. It was absolutely crazy. I'm glad he didn't talk. You know, you mentioned Denver. There was a lot going on. I'm going to just put it that way, in Denver at the time. And they didn't have the structure in place that they have now.
Right. I mean, that doesn't surprise me, you know?
Like, it was just a different management. And
But the thing is, D.A., like, a team doesn't go, like, have the record that Denver has because the coach is just fucking horrible.
Right. Exactly.
Like, that's it. Everything else is great.
Right.
It's just the coach. Exactly. No, that's
not
how
this works. Same teams are in the lottery every year. You notice that?
Right.
It's not by accident.
There's a lot more that goes into it.
All right. So let's wrap up with this. I wanted to talk about the Super Bowl a little bit.
Yeah.
And not really about the game, because the game was terrible. I agree with you. But Black Twitter is killing the weekend. They're killing him, Waz. They're just killing my boy. And I ain't even like a fan of the dude. I know his songs and all that. I'm not even a fan. I don't even really mess with him that much. I just think it's so easy to shoot at a young Canadian brother. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
He didn't come from the hood or whatever, but that doesn't mean he didn't have an experience too. You know what I mean?
Like, no, for sure. And he has a cool story. And, you know, for me, the experience of watching the show is going to be different, right? Because I was a fan of his from very early on when he was kind of like a little underground.
Yeah, yeah.
He was this Canadian guy that allegedly one of Drake's managers had found. And, you know, there was no pictures of him on the internet.
Right, right,
and he's making this really dark ass music about, you know, painful relationships and drug abuse and all of this stuff. And he basically crafted this whole persona, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, this is a guy who's come from literally being camera shy. They were scared to put themselves out there to do media, to do radio show appearances and all of that.
Right.
To now he's performing at this huge spectacle at the halftime show of the Super Bowl. And, you know, Blinded Lights is one of the craziest, biggest hits in the history of music.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a dope story for me. So I did enjoy the show. But I can understand the internet takes no prisoners. That's just, you know.
It just bothered me, man. Because, you know, like, right? So, I mean, he didn't, you know, his story is different than yours or mine. What does that mean? It's any less authentic. You know what I mean? Like, why do we always have to have the same story to confer authenticity upon Black people?
It's ridiculous.
Especially.
This guy was homeless at one point. This guy was homeless.
Right.
He lived on the streets at one point. So, and now he's performing in the Super Bowl.
Right.
Like, whatever. You know, that's the thing, David. Like, I've been on... Oh, I just had a birthday on Saturday.
Yeah.
So happy
birthday
belated, to me.
My brother. Yes.
Yes, I turned 34 on Saturday. I feel like I was on AOL maybe when I was 10 or 11. So that's... You know, 23, 24 years of the internet.
Right.
And they've always been this ruthless, dude.
Yeah, man.
It's just what they do.
Yeah, it just bothers me. I don't know. I feel like we need to do better. You know, like...
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
Everybody's comes from a different place. They have a different origin story. I mean, we're all different superheroes. You know what I mean? Like, we all have our own origin story, whatever.
Listen,
it is.
I'm never going to go against a Black dude publicly with my little forum, unless, of course, he's just blatantly and utterly Uncle Tommy.
Exactly.
Then I'll go after
him.
Other than that, like, I'm not going to go out against a Black dude, no matter what.
It's basically saying, oh, Black people can't have pop hits. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean it's ridiculous.
You know?
It's ridiculous.
Like, why can't he make some money? You know what I mean? Like,
it's ridiculous.
I don't care if, you know, white kids in Kansas like his song. So what? Who cares?
He's got a great story.
Yeah.
And his success is a testament to just the guy's talent and the work that he's put in, quite frankly. Because, you know, it's so crazy. Like, he had this breakout. And then when he had to make like his proper sort of commercial music, it didn't land automatically.
Yeah.
Then he went back to the drawing board and then he put out the freaking, I was about to say Eyes Wide Shut, the 50 Shades of Grey song.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's just been gone after that. So shouts to him.
Shout out to the Weeknd, man. Shoot. Anyway, thank you all for listening. As always, leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or wherever you listen to us every week. We enjoy it. We didn't do questions this week. We'll get questions again for next week. Send them in. No dumb questions. You know the rules. So send it into Athletic NBA Show on Twitter, and we'll pick two or three of them for next week. See you.